afternoon's Revenue Committee hearing. We have an agenda that is published, but we aren't going to take it exactly in order because of the availability of people. So we're going to open first a public hearing on House Bill 4093. If you'd introduce this, Christine, I appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4093 would increase a couple of limits that are associated with enterprise zones. Current statute allows for 17 rural enterprise zones and an additional 15 that are categorized as either rural or urban enterprise zones and 10 electronic commerce enterprise zones. This measure would increase that limit from 17 to 20 rural enterprise zones, 15 urban and rural enterprise zones, and 20 electronic commerce enterprise zones. Currently, enterprise zones are limited to a diameter of 12 miles. This measure would expand the zones to a limit of 15 miles in diameter. The time period for a standard enterprise zone is currently limited to 2 years, with an additional 2 years upon agreement. The measure would extend the time period so that the enterprise zone could go for an additional 3 years instead of just an additional 2 years. Enterprise zones, property tax exemptions currently have a revenue impact of $52.3 million in the 2009-11 biennium, and so the expansion of enterprise zones could increase that revenue impact.
Thank you. We have a couple of honored. Nope, you're not here for this one. Okay. Co-speaker Hannah, we're honored to have you here before the Revenue Committee. Invite you to testify.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Barnhart. My name is Bruce Hannon. I'm a state representative from House District 7. I represent vast portions of rural Lane and Douglas County. I'm very proud to do that. Your staff almost stole my thunder by talking about my bill. However, nicely done in terms of the basics about the bill. Areas in my district have perpetually high unemployment, and it lingers well above the 10% number. Like much of rural Oregon, the communities I represent are desperately searching for ways to encourage economic development and incentivize business activity. This is truly one way to solve a problem facing so many Oregon families. Unemployment and its additional reduced personal income not only impacts the quality of life for Oregonians, it also increases the need for government services, while at the same time handicapping the state's ability to pay for those very services. I believe the legislature has an obligation to provide Oregonians with solutions that enable them to create jobs, and we can do just that through House Bill 4093. This bill expands enterprise and e-commerce zone opportunities throughout Oregon. These zones have proven successful already, and all I'm asking is that we allow a successful program to grow. House Bill 4093 would allow local governments, if they choose to do so, to implement new enterprise zones by expanding the overall number of authorized zones. Or, if a local region already has a zone that is successfully creating jobs, they can choose to expand that zone or allow the duration of time to continue. Both of these provide additional incentives for businesses to locate and grow in communities across Oregon. In working with Business Oregon and Legislative Revenue, we estimate that this bill alone may create 8,100 plus jobs in Oregon over the next 5 years. The jobs have an average wage of $37,000 per year and create more than $1.6 billion in personal income. That personal income would generate approximately $121.5 million in income tax revenue, more than enough to cover the cost of the $700,000 to the state. Simply put, it just makes sense. I will be the first to say we don't know as much about why the program is successful. So I would like to ensure that House Bill 4093 includes a requirement that Business Oregon report back to the legislature on a regular basis about the program. When this bill hopefully comes before you in a work session, I will have an amendment to the language to that effect. I also recognize that while local decision-making is one of the strengths of this program, that decision-making process does not include all levels of local control. As a result, I would encourage cities and counties to closely coordinate with area special districts to ensure the most appropriate application of these programs. The bottom line is this. We need more jobs in Oregon, and the solution to getting them doesn't need to be complicated, state-centric, or expensive. We have proven mechanisms that encourage economic growth, and we can use those to create even more jobs for Oregonians. I appreciate the opportunity for you to hear House Bill 4093 in a public hearing today, but I do hope your consideration of this common sense bill does not end here. I hope you will schedule this bill for a work session as soon as possible to allow Oregon's local communities to get to work, putting Oregonians to work. Thank you, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Questions from committee members. Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much.
Thank you very
much. For your cogent presentation of this bill. We have a panel, Steve Dahl, Ann Hannes,
Alma Flores.
And on deck we have Jody Weiser and Mark Landauer.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm also representing the League of Oregon Cities as well. You'll see on testimony that's being distributed before you the logo of the Oregon Economic Development Association is also on there, and Steve Dahl is the president of OEDA, and he will speak about OEDA's support as well. We have been strong supporters of the Enterprise Zone program because it is one that local governments can do voluntarily and offer to businesses as an important incentive to locate in communities. This has been a tried and true incentive over the years since it was established over 25 years ago, and we've had a number of successes with Enterprise Zones. And being able to offer this to more communities around the state, I think, would be a plus and would help with economic development. On the back of the testimony I have, it shows a number of examples about Enterprise Zones and how it's been used successfully throughout the state. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve and Alma.
As I said before, my name is Steve Dahl. I'm president of the Oregon Economic Development Association, and I'm also the economic developer for Grants Pass, Oregon, down in southern Oregon. And what I'm going to do today is I'm going to tell you three stories. And the stories will tell you how effective Enterprise Zones and the e-commerce overlay has been for the state of Oregon. Last year, we were able to recruit Jefferson State Forest Products into Grants Pass. They promised 17 people. They now have 24 people working there. The cost to the state for this has been zero because they have been property taxes, and they've gotten the income tax off of the new jobs created. Now, when they came to Josephine County and Grants Pass, they were deciding to come between Olympia, Washington, and Grants Pass. And the reason, one of the reasons they chose Grants Pass is because of the Enterprise Zone. 24 jobs may not seem like much in Salem and Portland, but in Grants Pass, where the unemployment rate has been well over 15% over the last couple of years, one job is a victory. Now, another story I'll tell you about is First Call Resolution. They were a company based in Roseburg, and they're still based in Roseburg. They're a call center. They took advantage of the e-commerce zone. The state invested $62,000 in them to be able to come to Grants Pass. Because of the new income tax that this company generated, they were able to have $120,000 of income generated revenue for the state on a continuous basis. They guaranteed first about 65 employees. They are now up to 175 employees, and they peaked at 248 over this holiday season. The last one I want to talk about is Fire Mountain Gems. Fire Mountain Gems is the largest supplier of gems and beads in the nation on the internet. It took a year and a half from the investment in their Enterprise Zone to their investment was paid back, and I don't remember that investment off the top of my head, with benefits coming back to the state. The Enterprise Zone is a money winner, in my opinion, for the state. One of the reasons it works is because Washington does not have one and California does not have one. It is one of the competitive advantages we have as a state to bring in businesses. And I encourage the expansion of it because I believe it's going to help the state do better.
Thank you. Co-Chair Benz, Co-Chair Berger and Co-Chair Barnhart, thank you so much for having us here. My name is Alma Flores, and I am currently the Economic Development Manager for the City of Beaverton. I'm here today to express the City of Beaverton's full support of House Bill 4093. Currently, the City of Beaverton does not have an enterprise zone or e-commerce zone designation. Beaverton is a growing first-tier suburb of Portland with over 90,000 people and over 61,000 jobs. We strongly support a regional economic development strategy and have set an aggressive but realistic goal of increasing our employment by 30,000 jobs by the year 2030. Additionally, our community and economic development tools for business attraction and retention efforts, we don't have the necessary tools to meet those efforts and that goal to support our community. Just over the past year, our department has responded to several Business Oregon inquiries of firms in need of tax incentives. Additionally, over 8 businesses interested in Beaverton specifically have indicated expansion plans that would have benefited from an E-zone. These, with Portland to the east and Hillsborough to the west of Beaverton, both with enterprise zone designations, Beaverton is unable to participate in maintaining the region's competitive advantage with the gap in incentives that exist. Beaverton is competitively positioned within Washington County. It holds over 1/3 of the region's flex industrial space and offers over 82 acres of vacant and redevelopable land, industrial land. It is able to attract and access a robust electronic and electrical engineering, design, and software development workforce. Regional economies, and more specifically the communities within them, should be able to offer the same level of incentives in order to retain a company that is looking for land, labor, and infrastructure within those communities. Without the enterprise zone in Beaverton, we cannot take full advantage of the synergies that exist within our regional target markets, and we may be missing out on opportunities that could take advantage of our competitive location and our robust workforce. For these reasons, the City of Beaverton wholeheartedly supports this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have questions from this panel, for this panel? From this panel, for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jody Weiser, Mark Landauer.
What happened to our agenda? I managed to lose it here sometime. There it is.
Please, go ahead. Members of the committee, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So we know for sure that enterprise zones have been very successful. They've been very successful in reducing taxation. But when California did a study, what they found was that the growth next to enterprise zones was no different than the growth inside enterprise zones. While there are certainly people who locate there to get the benefits of being in an enterprise zone, many of those businesses would have been in that community anyway, and they will often locate next to it, and you'll see the same kind of growth. So their study doesn't support the idea that it really does economic development. It does make a good talking point when you're talking to a business. It gives communities something to talk about, but doesn't necessarily create jobs or create quality jobs. If these, if this bill does what it's trying to do, it would increase in number the number of zones, it would increase the size of the zones, and it would increase the number of years that zones, the short-term zones could be in effect. Why do we have this kind of scattered approach to changing things? Probably because we don't have any research that tells us we should have more zones, or we should enlarge our zones, or we should have another year of benefit from our zones. So we've just said, let's do everything. We currently have 60 enterprise zones. Just last session, you considered whether to extend the sunset of the enterprise zones. And you did choose to do so, but you didn't discuss this kind of expansion. And we're in the same economy now as we were then. I recently got the database for the businesses that are benefited from the enterprise zone. I want to share with you a few examples. Energy 2 made a $28 million investment. If we assume that the property taxes are $10 per thousand, which is average in our state, although it's high for the rural areas and low for the urban areas, that is 280, and they have 30 employees. So what we're essentially doing is paying them $933 per employee per year for as long as their enterprise zone lasts. In the urban areas, that would be 3, 4, or 5 years, and in the rural areas, that would be 15 years. The Synergy Data Center has only one employee. The business also made a small investment, only $775,000. But we lost property taxes of $7,750 for that one employee. We didn't probably get $7,750 worth of income taxes from them, so we've lost money again. The T. Girding Construction Company made a $2 million investment, so we lost $20,000 in taxes for one job. And again, remember, I'm using the $10 per thousand in all of these examples. I didn't look to see what county they were in because the program doesn't look to see what county they're in. It just has the formula that it always uses. And Snowtip Energy Freezing made a $15 million investment. They hired 2 new people. They retained 20 jobs. So the annual cost per the 2 new jobs was $75,000 in lost property tax revenue, or it's $6,800 per job if you talk about the retained jobs. So the bills that you have before you this session that talk about saying if you hire somebody, we'll give you $3,000, they're all less than these numbers. There's no bill that says we're going to give $9,300 or $6,800 for a job. Also, we probably need to increase our job standards for this. I'm not sure what session it was. It was probably 2009. Somebody was here from Business Oregon, one of you asked a question. How long do people stay in, do businesses stay on the program? And the answer was they generally stay 3 years, not 4 or 5. And you asked, why do they stay only 3 years? And the answer was because they don't pay well enough to qualify for the 4th or 5th year of property tax abatement. So the standard is 150% of county average wage for salary plus benefits. Well, as you know, salary plus benefits, that comes out to be about just a little bit above the county average wage. So we've got jobs that aren't not increasing the per capita income in our state being subsidized in these zones, and that doesn't seem like the right way to move the state forward. Recently, in December, I think it was, Good Jobs First put out a report called Money for Something. And they were looking at performance standards in states' economic development programs. They looked at 3 or 4, I don't remember which, different programs in each state and what was just in the law about what would be examined in deciding whether a business would be included in the economic development project. Oregon got a D- in that study. We were 4th from the bottom. Attached to my testimony is the metrics that they used to figure out what score a state was going to get. And then just a sample, there was like 20, it's a 98-page report, and there were 23 pages like the page you have that's like this, that just showed the kinds of metrics that other states have around their economic development programs. I encourage you to think about whether, if we do this, should not we have performance standards for the business the first year they come into the enterprise zone rather than after 3 years. Thank you.
Mr. Orlando, why don't you proceed and then we'll ask for questions.
Very good. Co-chairs Berger and Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts of Oregon, Special Districts Association of Oregon today. And as it may come as no surprise to you, our association opposes House Bill 4093. And I've been here before articulating our concerns with this program. You'll recall I was here before you last session when you were considering extending the sunset, and as I have told many of my friends who will listen, I felt like a possum trying to cross I-5 during rush hour and barely even got into the emergency lane, so here I am again. You know, according to the tax expenditure report, the state, the property tax loss estimate for 11-13 is approximately 32.9. It was obviously south of what staff has stated, and so I wanted to point that out, that my figures in my written testimony may be in conflict with your staff's, but I did want to point out that amount of money is significant. Currently, only cities and counties are given the authority to provide a designation for an enterprise zone. And, of course, as a special district, we are therefore bound by the decision of either the city or county when they do, in fact, create these enterprise zones. Of course, those types of overlapping taxing jurisdictions include special districts that are fire, library, park and rec, and those types of districts. But they also include school districts, and community colleges. We believe that overlapping jurisdictions, and I've shared this with you before, ought to have the ability to choose whether or not to participate in these property tax exemptions. I have little doubt that cities or counties would want the similar treatment if they were in the same position that we were, in that the cities and counties can unilaterally exempt the property tax going to a special district. We believe that allowing a special district to have that opt-out will create a better dialogue amongst all the parties who have a stake in that type of a decision. In 2007, SDAO commissioned a study on enterprise zones, and several recommendations were forwarded as a result of that study. Some of those recommendations included more rigorous reporting requirements, and we really ought to be looking at what are the long-term impacts of these enterprise zones. Are they creating jobs for the long term, or is it just a flash in the pan, if you will? There are also a few alternatives that could be used that would have largely the same impact as enterprise zones. For example, the state has a new construction tax exemption that is available to either industrial or commercial properties when they are in construction. And that property tax exemption is good for 1 year. One idea would be to just apply that statewide and increase the amount of time that tax exemption is available, say 2 or 3 years. If you want to say that Oregon is open for business, that is one way you could do it. Everybody would be subject to the exemption, rather than pitting community to community against one another in these types of attempts to attract and expand business. You have the rest of my testimony. I've made these arguments to you before, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have. One last point I would like to just note. I appreciated co-speaker Hannah's willingness to listen to our concerns. I know that he expressed interest in trying to get further dialogue amongst all the stakeholders in this, and I do appreciate his willingness to listen to our concerns. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Yes, Representative.
Here. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question partially for staff here. Mr. Landauer brought up about he's estimating the cost about $32.9 and $34.6 million in lost property taxes. Staff is reflecting 52.3 million revenue impact. That's 52.3 million revenue impact to the state. Favorable increase, or what is that?
It's a representative area. It's a loss, and it's based on local county and local taxing districts and schools, so the recipients of property tax revenue. And that would be the sum of all the different types of enterprise zones, long-term rural and regular enterprise zones, as well as renewable energy enterprise zones.
So that's lost not to the state's revenue stream, it's lost to...
Okay,
thank you for that clarification. And then for a question for Ms. Weiser, mm-hmm. you mentioned about the cost, the subsidy cost per job gained is quite expensive. Do you know the cost to the state for each unemployed person?
I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. If I could clarify, Christine, is your 52 a biennial or a annual number?
I'm sure that's a biennial number for 2009-11.
Thank you. Further questions from these folks? Without anybody speaking, I would like to say that co-speaker Hannah did point out that he shares your sense that we need more data, and were we to expand these, he would amend this to include sort of a report back so we can get better information about the workings of this particular program. So I presume that came out of your conversation? And that you
indeed. Our greatest fear, frankly, is the additional year that would be available under this program. This program has grown substantially since it was first authorized by the state legislature. We're up to, I believe, 59 or 60 enterprise zones. And despite the fact that this would increase it even further, the additional years is frankly one of the biggest concerns that we have. So with that.
Okay. Thank you. We have no one else signed up to speak on this particular issue. Anyone ready to come forward? I don't see anyone jumping forward, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4093. And we're going to move up the one agenda item and open public hearing on House Bill 4041. Representative Vance, would you like to come forward and bring with you anyone that you'd care to share the dais with? You want to introduce this topic while staff is introducing?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4041 today has three amendments before you. The Dash 1 amendment expands somewhat the exemption that would be applicable to property tax exemptions due to providing housing for low-income persons, and it extends that exemption.
Okay.
And the Dash 1 amendment would extend it to people who or governments that provide affordable housing under the Federal Code 25 USC 4132, which is has a number of requirements with provision of nonprofit housing. The Dash 2 amendment would be to completely remove the provision that low-income housing would receive the property tax exemption. And also the Dash 3 amendment would add the requirement that tribal governments who claim the property tax exemption file a claim for the exemption with a county assessor, containing a number of just required bits of information. The revenue impact from the bill, the measure, as any of the amendments here, would be approximately $500,000 to counties, local tax districts, and schools. And this is due to numerous properties that are around the state that would now become exempt from property tax due to this bill. But obviously the revenue impact would be greater for any amendment that includes the low-income housing as well. So that option would have a revenue impact associated with it in addition.
That would be the...
either the dash, the dash one.
The dash one.
Or the main bill.
Or the main bill.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The main bill also doesn't encompass, I don't think it has all the language that was desired for, you know, the federal low-income housing statute. There's some cleaned-up language in the dash one to be considered. So the language in the main bill isn't quite as extensive as what would be in the dash one as far as low-income housing.
Okay. And the dash three?
And the dash three, it just then adds the requirement that they report to the county assessor as they receive their exemption, and they'd have to give a number of required bits of information to the assessor in order to get the exemption. And that process is in place for a number of other exemptions, too. So,
thank you, Christine. Welcome, representative and distinguished guests. And I will leave you to present this to us.
Chair Berger, co-chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Cliff Bentz, District 60. So at the end of our last session, a bill was brought similar to this, and it had some definitional difficulties, so I offered to work with the tribes to work out those definitions. And we started meeting early in the summer, and we continued those meetings through the summer into the fall, and frankly right up until a couple of weeks ago. The challenges presented by this situation are significant, and fortunately the tribes brought excellent help, and we were able to work through those challenges. Some of the definitions we were not able to work out, such as cultural, ceremonial, archaeological, and environmental, I think I've got that right word, where we simply could not put a quantification on those types of uses. So they're not in the bill as they were previously. The bill also contains a series of other standards that have to be met before governmental services, such as the ones that tribes wish to be tax exempt, would be allowed. There's actually four standards that apply. The first is that the governmental use has to be exclusive. The second, it has to be equivalent to services that a state or local or federal government might provide. The third, it has to be related to a certain set of types of use. And the fourth, it has to not generate income beyond that, exceeding the actual cost of the activity. These were all, to one degree or another, refined or added to the bill. Finally, there is a dash three, I think, amendment that requires that a tribal government interested in utilizing one of these exemptions go to the tax assessor and appropriately file. To me, this bill reflects a great deal of hard work and also an approach, I think, to the long-term benefit of these two governments, our state of Oregon government and these tribal governments. And my hope is that these types of bills will bring the two closer together, and that the activities that we engage in that are similar in purpose be taxed similarly. That's a hope, and there's a lot of work to be done to get there, but I believe this bill takes a strong step in that direction. So without commenting on the cost of the bill, because I had not heard it until this very moment, I will say that I would support it. What ways and means may do with that cost, I do not know. But I would support the bill and encourage the tribes to continue to work this way with local governments and state governments. And so with that, I'll leave it to these gentlemen to explain their take on the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. The tribe.
Could you state your name for the
record? Les Minthorn. I'm the chairman of the Confederated Tribes, Eastern Oregon. It's our home base up in Umatilla County. And we certainly appreciate the work of Representative Bentz to get us this far on this legislation with this particular tribe and those other tribes in the state of Oregon that have the same issues. And we're here to express our support for this House Bill 4041 and look forward to some time in the future when we can implement the provisions, whatever they may be. And so the other point that we'd like to recognize is that this particular bill provides services, and at least it recognizes the services that our nation and other tribal nations in the state have been providing those services to a community within our boundaries that are a burden, not a burden, but it belongs to the tribe. We take care of those fire, police services, the necessary services that are on our community, whether it's tribal or non-tribal. And so we have sewer, fire, police, and sometimes when these services are being provided, we're still in the fee status. We're still subject to the state taxing rules. And so with the implementation of this bill sometime in the future, we believe that it's going to provide consistency and efficiency in the policy by not taxing the tribe for lands that are fee. And we have all types of property, tax property, tribal fee, trust property, but in this arena, we're interested in the fee lands not being taxed when we provide those services. We also feel that the tribe is probably in the best position to provide those services up in our arena with our county right next door. Those properties that are fee or tribal, we believe the tribe is in the best position to provide those essential governmental services, public services, and not provide the challenge that the county normally would have to provide in the absence of tribal government taking care of those as best as we know how. And since we have been providing the technical work from our legal and our tax department and our tribal staff on this government-to-government relationship, we hope that in the future, this relationship that we're building, at least with this bill, will provide a better definition for some of the other things that are not included in this bill. As you heard earlier, some of the things were excluded. Later on, once the bill becomes law and we have an implementation process, the definitions will become clearer for the state as well as the tribes that are hoping to have this bill passed. And for our tribal nation, we believe that this is in the best interest for our tribe to work with the state, and we encourage and hope that this group would pass and support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Shipper.
I'm co-chair, Mr. Co-chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I represent the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. We support the Dash 1 and Dash 3 amendments, and we do not support and we oppose the Dash 2 amendments. Before I turn to the Dash 1 and Dash 3 amendments, I want to add my thanks to those who have already been expressed for Representative Bence's involvement. Tribes look to the state government for a government-to-government relationship, and I think in the many discussions we had with Representative Bence, we asked and tried to answer hard questions, and I think the bill is dramatically better for the fact of the Representative Bence's patience with us and the great amount of time that he devoted to improving this this bill. I do want to turn briefly to the Dash 1 amendments. The tribe that I represent is poised to undertake a tribal private for-profit partnership that will result in the construction of low-income housing in Florence. That project, if undertaken in the same way that we would like to do it by a public housing authority, would result in a property tax exempt project. That exemption is the key to fueling the interest that for-profit partners have in joining with governmental entities to produce the governmental good of greater low-income housing stocks. Without that that exemption, that kind of public-private partnership just doesn't pencil out. So the Dash 1 amendments in the shortest possible version change the equation so that instead of treating a tribe that wishes to enter into such a public-private partnership and produce the governmental service of low-income housing being subject to tax subject to taxation, it changes the current law so that we would be entitled to an exemption on the same terms as a public housing authority would be. And that's the gist of the Dash 1 amendments. They are superior to the Dash 2 amendments and to the current text of the bill as it pertains to public housing. The Dash 2 amendments would eliminate any extension of the exemption to Indian tribes under these circumstances, and so we don't support the Dash 2 amendments. And the existing language of the bill is simply difficult to understand and apply and to create that equivalence of outcome, so the Dash 1 amendments are superior from several technical standpoints. The Dash 3 amendments focus on the mechanics of the system by which tribes would earn the entitlement to the exemption that's provided by the Dash 1 and other elements of the printed bill. ORS 307-162 requires certain organizations or institutions that are entitled otherwise to a statutory property tax exemption first, though, to submit to the county tax assessor a claim that is verified under oath, essentially establishing why it is that they think they're entitled to the exemption under whichever of the applicable statutes would be. For example, senior centers, certain kinds of senior centers who also, under the Oregon statute, or qualify under specific terms of the Internal Revenue Code, must justify themselves through this process to the county tax assessor before they can enjoy the tax exemption that otherwise would be extended to the senior center that's constructed in compliance with the Internal Revenue Code. And so what the Dash 3 amendments do is subject tribes to that same obligation, so that when tribes have checked off all the elements that they need to satisfy the substantive requirements for the exemption, then we have to take that and give notice to the property tax assessor in each county to establish our entitlement to the exemption. We think that's an appropriate requirement, though I note I don't think that actually in that respect public housing authorities have to do that same notice requirement, but we're satisfied that for tribes that's appropriate to add to this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Questions? Yes. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What was the revenue impact to the counties for not the amendments, but just for House Bill 4041? I didn't catch that.
Representative, the bill by itself, there are a number of properties that would be exempt from taxation, and that's approximately $500,000 in impact. The impact in the future, if the low-income housing portion is approved, could be greater than that. But this is reflective of non-low-income housing type properties that are just general government services and what exists right now, which would be approximately $500,000 in tax
without revenue. Without the Dash 1 amendments.
No.
Correct. Well, there's...
That's what's confusing me, because the $500,000 is listed on the Dash 1 revenue impact, so that's why I'm slightly confused.
I think there could be some clarification there that, you know, it would be additional if this tax incentive gives incentive to create these low-income housing areas, then it would be an additional impact, but it could be in the future. It's unknown what it is or how much.
Clarification then. Without the Dash 1, just purely the 4041, it's $500,000 to the local property tax recipients. And with these amendments, it's probably going to run a little bit more.
Okay.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I haven't seen the fiscal impact. I am surprised by the number, however, and we'd be interested in working with your staff to think through that. We tried to do an actual physical inventory of properties, actually count the properties that would be entitled to an exemption under the bill that are not now entitled to the exemption, and others were more intimately involved in that, but I know that the number was dramatically less than $500,000. So we'd be pleased to work with your staff to work through that. I'm not suggesting that it's wrong. I'm just saying I haven't seen it, and it does seem different than what I had understood the impact to be.
Representative Benz, do you want to weigh in on this? Do you have any further thoughts on these amendments?
Only, Madam Chair, that we've worked on this at great length and through three or four different possible low-income housing definitions and finally ended up with the one we have.
The dash.
The dash.
One.
Okay. And let me just mention, it may not be immediately obvious, but I was concerned about having a limit on the dash one. And so if you look down at the bottom, line 22, you'll see that it says the property is located in a county in which more than 10% of the enrolled members of the eligible Indian tribe reside. My thinking there had been that I didn't really want this exemption to be available no matter where in the state. I want it to be available with some link to those who are enjoying the exemption. And so that's what that is there for. Now, how much value that has would depend upon where 10% of different tribes reside and how large those tribes are and so forth and so on. But it seemed to me to be consistent with the underlying rationale that we were going to extend this benefit to Indian tribes. So I point this out because it's not immediately obvious. Yet another limitation that we developed in putting together this this exemption.
If I could inquire, the dash twos then take the language out.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I may.
Please.
The dash twos were developed because we were not sure we would ever reach agreement on what now is reflected in the dash ones. So we had that available in case we didn't. And so, but in my opinion, given the limitation that we have in place geographically and with the 10% solution, as we were calling it, then it will work. I was a little surprised at the numbers. But the idea, we want to encourage low-income housing. That's the concept. And so that's kind of the overriding goal.
Thank you. Further questions for this panel? Is there anyone else out there who would like to come forward on this particular issue? We are in public hearing. I think that in light of the complications of these, we probably will not go further today, but this we will revisit this issue and have a chance for all to ask further questions of staff. And so I appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4041. Paul, do we have our paperwork on 4039? Thank you. We will stand in adjournment. In recess, I'm sorry. We will stand in recess for 5 minutes.
Tell the next thing.
Okay, welcome back. The Revenue Committee is back in session after a brief recess. We are going to move committee members to a public hearing on House Bill 4132. We are expecting some of our colleagues to come down and to hear from them, but I'm going to let Paul introduce it, and we have other folks who want to testify, so we will move forward.
Madam Chair, House Bill 4132 links the reductions in tax expenditures to allotment reductions. The allotment reduction process, as you recall, is actually conducted by Department of Administrative Services, directed by the governor. What this measure would do is require that tax expenditures be reduced by the same percentage as the allotment reduction. And tax expenditures presumably would refer to the definition that's in ORS 291.201, which is the basis for the tax expenditure report.
Okay. Questions for Paul? I'm going to go ahead and call you guys in as panels. Paul Estro?
Zastro,
I'm sorry, Paul. That's a Z, clear as a bell. And Steve Robinson and Lori Wimmer, if you folks would come forward. Oh, Paul. Okay, no. I've got you. And, Paul, you've signed up first, so you get to speak first.
Okay, Representative Berger, members of the committee. My name is Paul Zastro. I reside at 5690 Collins Road in Hood River. I come wearing several hats today. First off, I am a taxpayer. Secondly, I am a retired educator, having, I guess you could say, either been on the receiving end as well as the giving end, and now on the, I guess one would say, administrative end of delivering education services, first as a student, then as a teacher of 31 years, and now 16 years on a an ESD board. I also serve in several other capacities, mainly as a president of the Hood River County Senior Citizens Incorporated, where we do deliver services to seniors, and also on the Parkdale Fire Board, where we deliver services in that fashion as well. I come asking for your positive consideration of the allotment cut equity bill, primarily because it seems only fair as well as equitable that the distribution of funds when you have an economic downturn is exactly that. It's equitable and it's fair. Right now what happens is that schools, as an example, get cut, but if I qualify for a tax break because I bought something new or because of my house or because I deliver my $50 check to a political party, then I get the full amount. It doesn't really seem fair. I think it's time we look at the whole range of, if we are in an economic downturn, that everybody has a share in making Oregon a better place to live. So everybody ought to also have that same equivalent share in if they have a smaller amount of the pie, so to speak, not just to those services such as senior services, education, police, and fire. So that's what I'm here for.
Thank you. Would you, Lori, please allow Representative Buckley to come
Absolutely.
Ahead of you? Thank you. Come forward, Representative Buckley. We were waiting for you, and we appreciate you came earlier, and we'll let you have the floor.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. Thank you for your courtesy. I greatly appreciate it. This bill is actually a fairly straightforward proposal, and I think I might be uniquely qualified to talk about the ramifications of it. I was appointed a co-chair of Ways and Means in December of 2008, right about the time that the Governor Kulongoski did a $112 million allotment cut as we were heading towards the end of that budget cycle. By the time we got into the session in 2009, that had increased to a drop of $880 million in the state budget. The allotment scenario was also used in 2010. As you know, when we got the revenue forecast, we had to go through a series of both allotment cost cuts and e-board actions. And I can tell you, it's the allotment cut process is a blunt instrument that it can only be made to work if there is the resources through the emergency board to mitigate the worst of the cuts that you're taking with the allotment. To give you some idea of where we were in 2009, with the amount of dollars that were being cut through the allotment process without any kind of resources to mitigate. Hello, Representative Kotak.
Hello, Representative.
We were looking at scenarios of closing down our K-12 system. We were looking at shutting down community colleges and our universities in the spring of 2009. We were looking at eliminating Oregon Project Independence. We were looking at severely cutting the long-term care programs. We were looking at shutting down our courts. The state was in that level of crisis. At that point, we received federal stimulus dollars the last weekend in March of 2009. I don't think I slept that entire weekend. We did get the information that there would be stimulus dollars, and we plugged stimulus dollars in along with the allotment cut that the governor did in order to balance the budget and to keep basic functions of our state government going. In the scenarios after the 2009-11 budget were passed, we went through allotment cut scenarios again with drops of hundreds of millions of dollars. If we had not had the resources in e-board to mitigate cuts, we're looking at, again, scenarios of closing the Oregon Youth Authority, closing a number of facilities, laying off 300 employees, releasing hundreds of young offenders into communities. We are looking at severe cuts again to seniors and people with disabilities. We eked by because we were lucky. We got a little bit of help again from the federal government in August of 2010 that allowed us to keep vital programs going. We did not have to close prisons. We did not have to release inmates. We were able to keep our courts functioning. We were able to actually let our K-12 system open the school year in September of 2010 without cutting their budgets. But we only stuck through by the skin of our teeth because we did have a little bit of money in e-board and we got a little bit of help from the federal government. What this bill does, it simply says when the state of Oregon's in crisis, it's all of our responsibility. It's all of us. It's not the school teacher's responsibility alone, or the cop on the streets alone, or the prison guard, or the university professor, or the judge. It's all of our responsibilities. It's not the in-home care worker's responsibility. It's all of our responsibilities. And if we're willing to take a step like this, which I think is ambitious, but I think it's clear and I think it's fair, if we're willing to take a step such as this, it basically says when we're in crisis, everybody's going to come to the forefront. Everybody's going to come to the forefront and help the state of Oregon. Yes, we're going to ask our teachers yet again to do less with more, but we're also going to ask people like me who take deductions on my taxes to take a little bit less of a deduction, to spread out the resources that are needed, the seeking the resources that are needed to spread out that cause so it doesn't come out of just the work that is done for us by people who work in our schools, in our prisons, in our courts, in our hospitals. It actually asks each one of us as Oregonians, particularly those of us who have a little bit extra ability to contribute a little bit more, it asks us to do so and takes it out of the political arena. It no longer becomes a fight over this tax expenditure or that tax expenditure or whether a teacher gets paid too much or a state policeman gets paid too much. It takes into the situation of saying the state of Oregon is in crisis. We have to react to it. We're going to react to it by cutting budgets across the board as needed to mitigating the cuts as best as we can, but we're going to use the resources not only of the income taxes of the people of the state of Oregon, but also the tax deductions that are listed in this book. And I know this committee knows this book very well, but we're talking about a cut, and people bring up like the political tax credit, which I take a political tax credit, and if I got $3 less of a tax credit one year and I knew I could help keep my schools open, I'd be happy to do so. So again, the bill is simple in its concept. The idea is that every Oregonian pitches it in a crisis and we get through crises together. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, for tolerating my passion for the subject.
I love your passion, Representative Buckley. Thank you for being here, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Representative Tina Kotek, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Happy to be here and always happy to follow the good Representative Buckley from Ashland. You know, I've been around long enough. One of my first sessions here as a advocate for the Oregon Food Bank was 2001, when we lived through many special sessions. And, you know, I've noticed how inappropriately we use across-the-board cuts. But it is an authority the governor has when we're not in session. And it's always occurred to me that if we're going to treat one side of the state spending ledger one way with across-the-board percentage cuts, we should treat all state spending the same way. Ergo, the bill, House Bill 4132, talking about tax expenditures, and this committee knows them well, credits, deductions, exemptions, the whole lot. Is it fair to say we're going to cut a program over here that lays off a teacher or a firefighter, but not look at other things in the manual that you know? If you flip through here, you see things. I was just flipping through earlier. I was like, what's a good example? Well, there's one about, you know, a tax break for out-of-state financial institutions. That might be a very good one, but is it somehow equal or more important than things on the programmatic side that we have expenditures for? I don't think so. I don't think we know, more accurately. We don't know. So when we're not here and the governor has an allotment authority because we're in a fiscal crisis, it is only fair, as Representative Buckley said, that it's, you know, you have equity on both sides of the state spending ledger. And as we've done in allotment crises, if we are in session and we're able to come back and adjust those things, we could do the same thing with this side. But the way this bill is written, it says if we're going to have fairness in our process, if we're going to treat state spending in a crisis with across-the-board cuts, it must not just be the program side. It has to be the tax expenditure side as well. That is the only way to do it with fairness. And I think the way it was expressed by Representative Buckley of how that could be taken at the individual level is certainly something I think many Oregonians could support. So I urge your further discussion and working on this bill and moving it on to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the representatives? Appreciate you coming down, talking to us. Thank
Our
you
pleasure.
Very much.
Thank you so much.
And I'll bring Mr. Robinson and Lori Wimmer back up. And you're welcome to come back up, sir, in case the panel has questions for you.
One never knows.
Thank you. Go ahead.
For the record, I'm Steve Robinson. I work at Decision Metrics in Eugene. I want to start by giving you some numbers that may surprise some of you. I feel pretty comfortable in sharing these numbers with you. You've got my testimony in front of you. I'm going to refer to the graph that's on one side of that piece of paper. I feel reasonably comfortable telling you this because I've run this analysis. When I started it last spring, I ran it by the current state economist and two former occupants of that position, along with a number of peer reviewers. Since then, a couple of 100,000 people have been exposed either in writing or to video or oral presentations of this, and as yet there hasn't been any critique of the analysis, so I'm pretty comfortable with it. As you can see on the graph that I'm showing you, this is the trend in tax expenditures over the past 12 years. And after you adjust the number, these are numbers out of the tax expenditure report and out of the official budget document. These are all posted numbers on official numbers online. After adjusting each of these numbers for inflation and personal income growth in the state, the income tax expenditures in our state have grown nearly $3 billion over what they were in 1999-2001. And at the same time, general fund spending has dropped. I prepared this graph last spring. It was $2.4 billion then, and obviously it's another $300 million less now. So it's $2.7 billion drop in general fund spending. And there's an obvious relationship there. When money goes out in terms of in the form of tax expenditures, it doesn't come into the general fund, and it cannot be spent for general fund programs. Down at the bottom of that page, I included some key facts. The average biennial increase in tax expenditures has been nearly $500 million. The last biennial increase was $900 million. In other words, the problem is not only bad, it's getting worse. It's accelerating. In 9901, the tax expenditures consumed 36% of potential state revenues, income tax revenues. In 1113, the current biennium, it's 46% and heading north. That's a 10% increase. And the result of that 10% increase is a reduction in general fund resources of $2.7 billion in this current biennium, an additional loss of federal funds that we're leaving on the table, federal matching funds of $1 billion. So the total effect on discretionary spending in this biennium is $3.7 billion. So that's the scope of the problem as I see it. Now, in referring to the bill in front of you, the House Bill 4132 will provide an important safeguard for critical state services in the event of future fiscal emergencies resulting from federal revenue shortfalls in excess of budgeted reserves. The question here is one of simple fairness. The concept of allotment cuts is based on sharing the pain of emergency budget cuts across all general fund programs. Until now, however, income tax expenditures, which are just as closely linked to the general fund as education, public safety, and health care, have not borne their share of the pain. This bill fills that gap in Oregon law, and I urge you to pass it. Please understand, however, that this bill is no more than a drop in the bucket of red ink that has resulted from the growth of tax expenditures over the past 12 years. It doesn't touch the most significant source of the problem, which is our connection with the federal tax code. Over 81% of the $480 million biennial increase in tax expenditures over previous levels, even after adjusting for inflation and growth, stems from the federal code. I have some ideas about how to address that, the federal problem, which I'll save for another time. Meanwhile, please take this opportunity to take a small step in the right direction. We desperately need to start gaining some control over the explosion of tax expenditures and the damage they have been causing to the general fund.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Co-Chair, and committee members. For your record, my name is Lori Wimmer, and I'm representing 45,000 teachers and other school employees of the Oregon Education Association, and I'm also Chair of the Oregon Revenue Coalition. We're very appreciative of your time this afternoon. Thank you so much for hearing this bill, and we also offer our thanks to the 11 legislators who are sponsors or co-sponsors of this legislation this session. On behalf of our members, it's our pleasure to testify in support of House Bill 4132 because, as you've heard, we believe it's a matter of fairness and fiscal responsibility. And just to back up a little bit, as I'm sure you know, because of the global economic crisis, we've lost nearly 10,000 education employees alone in the last 2 years. Across the state. And that is not only a tragedy with respect to the quality of the educational experience we can offer our students, but it's also, because we are the number two employer in the state of Oregon, it is also an economic stimulus issue or an economic health for local communities issue. And so we would urge you to schedule this bill for a work session and offer it due pass to the House floor because we believe that this very modest proposal would help us when you are not in session and when the governor has no choice but to enact across the board cuts to rebalance a budget that everyone have, as someone so eloquently put it to me one year, skin in the game. We know that it doesn't make sense when we are at such a desperate level, at the lowest possible level for funding on a per-student basis for education that we've known in decades, to think about the possibility next spring or the year after to go through what we went through just in 2010, which you've had explained to you already, in which we are cutting back even more. We've heard from educators across the state about what they're looking at. Just to give you an example in class size, we have a teacher who is about 5 years from normal retirement who is double certified as a music teacher and also a foreign language teacher. And this year in her school in Central Oregon, she's being asked to teach orchestra over the school PA system to 60 kids who are now in the cafeteria. She also has 55 students in her foreign language class. She's so demoralized by her inability to actually provide an education to these students that she is elected to retire in June. And it's a real tragedy for the students in that school. She's an excellent teacher. She is certainly not alone. There are story after story we're hearing as they're rolling in the devastation of these cuts.
I appreciate the stories, but should we stay on the bill?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just saying that these situations are exacerbated when only one side of the ledger is used to rebalance the state budget in a time of crisis, and we know we'll have future crises, and so we hope that you'll enact this bill for fairness for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. Questions for this panel? Steve, I have one. Maybe this is really a staff question. If I understand this bill, it only applies to state tax expenditures.
Right.
So all of the federal things like mortgage interest deduction would not be included in this,
right.
Nor would the personal exemption that is part of our, which are the big ticket items.
I think the personal exemption would be.
Would be.
It would be.
Would be? Okay.
That's so a that, credit, state credit.
So that would be the one that would be the biggest piece. And so if I understand the way this would work, the governor makes an allotment, and so the next time you file your taxes, your exemption is reduced by, say, 3.5% or whatever percent of the allotment. And if you were planning to do your $50 political, it would be $50 worth less 3.5% or something.
$1.75.
Okay. And
that raises a question for me, if I may. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And maybe the same one you're aiming toward. Why exclude the federal items?
That's what it says, state tax.
Right. Why exclude the items on Schedule A from this treatment? I mean, there may be a perfectly good reason that I don't get.
Co-Chair and Co-Chair Barnhart, we worked with Legislative Council. Originally, this was a 2011 bill, so I'm thinking back. We just recycled it for this session. But I think it was for technical reasons, technical ease. We certainly would be amenable to, amendment if that were your goal. But I think we were going for a modest proposal.
Further questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one. This would impact also the earned income tax credit as an expenditure as well. So this would impact everybody as well. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. We have three more. John Mullen, Arch Kelly, Jody Weiser. And anyone else who wants to speak on this, get ready, because I'll ask for you next. Thanks, John.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen here as Co-Chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. I'm going to be very brief today because I think there's been excellent testimony already. It was sometime in the last century when the tax expenditure report was first formalized and gave people an opportunity to understand that part of how Oregon does business. But I want to commend this committee, in fact, the Joint Committee, the Tax Credit Committee, for the work that you have done. I think that basically what has happened over all of the years of having this kind of discussion about the budget side of the ledger and what's involved with cuts to human services programs for things that we're concerned with, and also then taking a look at the other side of the ledger as far as tax expenditures are concerned, these are issues that I think Representative Buckley said it very well. This is something that affects all Oregonians. Personally, I would not be immune from a reduction of this kind, having two small businesses and rental property, but this is also something that I feel as Oregonians, when we think about the value of human services, other programs that are valuable to the state of Oregon, that when we're asking those people to sacrifice, we also ask the taxpayers to sacrifice as well. And that concludes my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Berger and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women of Oregon. Our approximately 1,800 members have had for a long time equitable tax treatment at all levels of government in our public policy. And as you know, we've worked on tax expenditures year in and year out. So we do commend this bill to your perusal. We think that it's a small way to start in looking at overall tax, but at least it gives the governor and the executive branch of government a way to stop the bleeding only on the program side. I was going to use an example. We have I have breakfast every Friday morning with a counselor in the Salem-Keizer School District. There are 1.6 counselors at a junior high with 823 students. That's a critical age for kids, and that level of counseling is just abysmal. This would maybe help to get it up to two counselors for 823 kids. Thank you.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. Last night, the work group on bills was meeting, and the person who was supposed to report on this bill said, "Is this bill for real?" They thought it might be a hoax or something because it was so unlike most of the bills we've been reading. We asked ourselves, what would be the easiest way to accomplish the laudable goals in the bill? And, you know, the governor is forced to do across-the-board cuts, but you can design a program that doesn't have to be across-the-board cuts. It doesn't have to hit EITC. It doesn't have to be as complicated as that would be, because you can target, if there's been an allotment cut, what would happen on the expenditure side. So the two easiest things would be to say, okay, we're cutting $175 million out of budgets. We're going to cut $175 million out of tax expenditures and look for where you would get that $175 million. And itemized deductions would probably be the first place to go, because it's a huge amount of money. And you wouldn't have to look at each item in there and say, well, yes, we'll still allow medical, but we won't do contributions or something like that. You would just say you will reduce your itemized deductions by whatever percentage it takes to get $175 million. Another alternative would be to put a cap, lower the cap on how much of our federal taxes can be reduced. You can deduct. I think, I don't even remember what the limit is now. I think it's like maybe 5,900 or something like that. So change that to whatever number it takes to create your $175 million. There are, of course, other revenue-raising options that could be used. You could reduce all tax credits, and that would be every tax credit from the political tax credit to the film and video tax credits. Or you could actually if this happens again, if there's a cut, we'll fix the senior medical deduction by just eliminating it. That would be $150 million in a biennium. Or we could eliminate or cut the 100% bonus depreciation 179 expensing. I mean, any of those things could be. You could write a law that says, if there's a cut, here's what we do. While making the Draconian cuts to the budget, we should not be subsidizing $1 million homes, and I think we all probably would agree to that. The effect of having those mortgages deductible is essentially a $4,000 tax break to anybody with $1 million or more home with a $1 million loan. And while we are telling seniors who have, are in very fragile financial positions that they are no longer eligible for the property tax deferral program, we are continuing to allow people living in $3 million homes with $1 million exemptions to deduct all of their interest. And I think one of the wonderful things about this bill is it could help bring to everyone's attention the differential there, the difference in our tax code and what happens when the tax expenditures are not touched and the budget is. This bill would bring those hidden expenditures to view. You know, the most important word in the phrase tax expenditures is the word spend. Because we need to spend through the tax code more frugally. What we're doing really is not increasing taxes. We are decreasing spending if we cut tax expenditures. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Paul, would this be a 36 vote?
Madam Chair, I think it's a strong possibility it would be. Yes, I would. I haven't sat down and talked with council about it, but I think that because you obviously the revenue impact would be indeterminate because we wouldn't have an allotment reduction that we could anticipate, but nonetheless, the effect of that action would obviously be a revenue raising. So I would have to sit down with council before I'd answer that definitively, but I definitely thought it's a possibility.
Okay. Thank you. I think that there would be more work to be done. Some of the questions that run through my mind on this. Before we go further with this in terms of some of the things that you raised and some of the things that about how this would work and which and I would also be very concerned about the administrative costs of this kind of thing. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to echo that. And one thing that I've really picked up over the conversation we've had today is how complicated all this is and how everyone says we all have our own ideas about the problems of a across-the-board cut. That's probably something we could all agree on. But everyone can then say, but this piece works, but this piece works, this piece doesn't work, and everyone has different ideas about that. In essence, I think that just underscores the problem of across-the-board cuts, because every piece of spending, every piece of tax expenditures, tax credits, all have different effects. They're all very complicated, and they all interact. So if nothing else, we've probably come to some consensus, if not unanimity, about problems of across-the-board approaches. So that part I like, but I agree with your statement very much that there's a lot more to consider about all the little intricacies and interactions.
Yes, Representative Bantha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These are, I'm not going to pose these as questions, but I would be interested in information concerning two different points that were raised. One, when this issue was brought up at the federal level, I think it was brought up in the context of the flat tax. The idea was that we would do away with all deductions and reduce income taxes by a proportionate amount. The thinking being that after a certain period of time, people become accustomed to the mortgage interest deduction and everything else, and the only way to get started appropriately is to take them off the tax rate and then work your way back up. And I thought that was kind of an interesting thought, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on it, not today, but offline. The other theme that floats through that which we've heard today is this belief that those who are on the government side have some sort of something, I don't want to call it a right, expectation of continuing to be paid. And I think that most of the taxpayers out in my district would say that they are somehow not the same. And whether that's right or wrong, I really can't say, but I can assure you that that's a pretty common belief, and that those who are paying into the government are more deserving of care that goes with the nature of a mortgage interest deduction than are those who are on the other side taking money out and being paid by the government. And so to equate the two, I think, is a challenge. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on that also. Not today, but offline. Thank you.
Representative Gelser also has a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's, in a lot of ways, a matter of framing. And I think whenever we talk about these revenue issues, it is a lot of that perception that is out in the community. I certainly hear that. I do wonder, though, how we think about comparing the value of a tax expenditure, my ability to write off my political contribution as compared to my daughter's right to attend school all year as a fifth grader, and what that investment means to the future of the state in terms of having a well-educated citizenry that grows up here. And I think sometimes we get caught on who's paying, who's being paid, and what we're looking at on that expenditure side of the ledger is less who's being paid and what it is that we are buying with those dollars and for that service. Is that care for the elderly? Is that quality teaching for our kids? Is that affordable access to higher education so we can meet our 40-40-20 goals? So I think as we discuss these issues, we have to be aware of those perceptions of are we protecting someone's pay over another person's pay? But I think we also need to look at the policy objectives of how do we compare the incentive of getting people to engage in the political process as it compares to the value of a full year of school or a full day of high school for students in Oregon, which, frankly, many school districts right now can't offer full-day high school, which I just always want to put that plug out there. I'm a big supporter of full-day high school.
Thank you. Representative Bear.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a clarification question for staff. So if I read the bill correctly and not be familiar with certain sites in it, this only applies when the governor is left with his only tool, which is across-the-board cuts. So having that clarification then, this would not apply, for example, in 2009 if the state legislature called itself back into session to manage the budget deficits. So if the legislature stepped up and actually managed the budget deficits, then we could judiciously not only go through on the budget cuts, we could also then at the same time go through on the tax expenditures judiciously as well. So this is really only when we as a legislature abdicate our responsibility, as I see it, to the governor rather than doing what we need to do as a legislature.
Thank you. I this has been a very good discussion, and I appreciate you coming in. And, Lori, I appreciate this coming forward and this kind of discussion we should have. Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4132. And I am going to, colleagues, open a work session on House Bill 4039. Here comes Christine. I think you'll be familiar with this one. Having to do with the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program and the discussion that we had last Friday, committee members. And Christine, you want to briefly describe the Dash 3 amendment and where we are on this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have just received the fiscal impact statement for this measure. The fiscal impact is found to be minimal. The Dash 3 amendment would just provide a provision that broadens the notification requirement against having a reverse mortgage at the same time as signing up for the deferral program. And it expands that to all providers of reverse mortgages rather than just those defined in ORS 706-008, which is only a subset of that group. Removes the reference to the Fair Trade Practices Act. And it extends a two-year reprieve to existing program participants whose sole reason for disqualification was the reverse mortgage. That was approximately 1,644 individuals who will have their tax paid for 2011-12 and 2012-13 in the tax years. There's details in the measure about how to provide the refunds for Department of Revenue to refund the taxes to the county assessors who will then refund the taxpayers. And it provides that there will be no interest paid either way. If it's delinquent or if there's money paid back, there's no interest due on that. And this Dash 3 amendment also adds the requirement that the Department of Revenue develop a survey instrument to be developed in consultation with the Legislative Revenue Officer and presented to the Interim Legislative Assembly Revenue Committees for approval. And the potentially one of the questions that could be asked on there would be pertaining to real market value or the equity in a home, because there could be other sources of lost equity aside from reverse mortgages, such as second mortgages or other home equity loans. And this measure has the Dashley Amendment in the two-year reprieve has a negative $6 million revenue impact in 2011-13 as those additional accounts are paid, and then slightly smaller positive impacts in upcoming biennia because of the additional amount that's borrowed, then the repayments will come in according to a set schedule. And that's the source of that revenue projection.
Okay. Committee members, do you have any questions before we proceed? No. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 4039.
Representative Barnhart moves the Dash 3 amendments be amended to House Bill 4039. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Mr. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 4039. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barnhart moves House Bill 4039 as amended with the Dash 3 amendments to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Bailey.
Just very happy we're here, Madam Co-Chair.
I think we are all very happy to be here at 4 to 5 on a Monday night. Okay, I think I'll take a roll call vote.
Aye.
Reed.
Aye.
Juan.
Aye.
Bailey.
Aye.
Fair.
Aye.
Barnhart. Aye.
Aye. The motion passes, and Representative Barnhart and I will share the honors on the floor of this. And with that, I have no more business before the committee.
Wednesday at 1.
Committee members, and we are adjourned.
Good news.
Thank you.
What? Oh.